a time of peace. I swear it's not too late.
This is Peace Talks, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Robert Stewart, director of the Canadian Center for Teaching Peace, wrote that peace is a science, a profession, a passion, a rigorous field of study, a journey of discovery into the time in advance of history books, a journey into the unknown of what people wish for the future. Today on Peace Talks, a look at peace studies programs in colleges and universities.
I'm Carol Boss. Let me introduce our guest today. Dr. Christine Rack teaches in the Peace Studies program at the University of New Mexico. She has her Ph.D. in sociology and has a book coming out in the fall entitled Latino Anglo Bargaining Patterns. Dr. Michael Nagler is Professor Emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. He is the founder and former chair of the Peace and Conflict Studies program and has devoted his life to exploring nonviolence as an alternative to war and is one of the world's most widely respected peace scholars and activists. I'll also be talking later on with Graham Bass, a student in the Peace and Global Studies program at Earlham College, who just returned from a semester in Northern Ireland. Michael Nagler, the Peace Studies program began at Berkeley in the 70s. Is that correct?
That's correct, Carol. It wasn't in the shape that it is now, but the initial experiments and my course on nonviolence, that began in the mid-70s.
Was it one of the earliest university programs of its kind then?
It was one of the earliest, especially since we were aiming for a degree-granting program, and many of the programs around the country, around North America, have an emphasis and a few courses, but not all of them will give you a degree in peace studies or peace and conflict studies. So from that point of view, we were fairly early, and at various times we've been one of the biggest programs in the country.
Would you tell us about the circumstances that resulted at that time in the birth of the program?
Well, okay, from my side, the impetus was I came to feel that Mahatma Gandhi was one of the most important human beings of the 20th century, and his major invention, nonviolence or ahimsa, was one of the most important things that anyone anywhere could study, and the university wasn't doing it, and it was pretty open at that time because the free speech movement had kicked open a few doors and we could afford to experiment. So I offered this course on Gandhi, and there was a huge turnout. There's like 100 students. For a first offering, that's pretty impressive. But then I went around looking for a department to put it in, and everybody had a good reason that it shouldn't be in their department. So I got very determined that this had to continue happening, and that then I figured that there had to be a department to put it in.
And currently Berkeley offers a major in?
Right. It's a Bachelor of Arts in Peace and Conflict Studies. And at the graduation on Saturday, one of the students quipped, "What's the difference between a cheese pizza and a PAX graduate?" And the answer is, a cheese pizza can feed a family of four.
I'm glad you didn't expect me to know the answer to this.
No.
Okay, can you sell young people on careers in peace?
Yes, you can, but you're not always exactly sure what shape those careers will take. Look, if we prepare people to go out and take up the standard jobs that have been created by the violence-accepting worldview that we now have, we will have failed. What we're doing is creating a class of people who will be able to come up with new jobs. And often we have found that to be the case. Our kids have been incredibly creative in finding ways to work all over the world. But if you don't want a lot of money, if that's not your main desire in life, if you want a life of meaning where you can go to bed at night feeling that you've helped to make the world a little bit better, then we can definitely sell them on high-powered careers, which will be very, very satisfying.
Christine Rack, the University of New Mexico's Peace Studies program is a newer kid on the block, but I think many might be surprised as to how long it's been around. Could you talk to us about its beginnings?
The Peace Studies program at the University of New Mexico probably began almost 1981, maybe, by McAllister Hall, who was a provost and a professor of physics, and he had also been working at the Los Alamos National Laboratories when the first tests of the nuclear bomb were going on. So he had that background, and then a woman from the community named Evelyn Sipp became convinced that the UNM ought to have a peace studies program, and she dogged everybody to make that so. It was originally housed in the philosophy department and was configured as a minor in arts and sciences. Really, when Jennifer Moore, who's the director now, came from the law school and took over the directorship, she brought peace studies into a whole new life, and it's currently in the sociology department, but the work of gathering faculty and gathering courses and gathering the energy that exists and putting it into the structure has been going on for the last year, and it's very exciting.
I'd like both of you, if you can, to talk about the philosophy and the mission and goals of a peace studies program.
Our mission statement is that students should have a better understanding of the dynamics of peace and of conflict and be able to make a more effective contribution to a world that is more characterized by peace and justice than the present world. And the way we've organized our course offerings here, there are four sort of basic pillars that we rest on. The one, of course, is nonviolence. That's my area. And then we do conflict resolution, where we try to actually get people ready to have a conflict resolution license of some kind in California. Then human rights, which sends students all over the world. And then finally, sort of a theory section on world order, political science, and the social science approach.
Christine, why don't you give us an idea of some of the classes offered in the Peace Studies program at the University of New Mexico?
We have a 24-credit-hour minor, so 12 of those hours are required. And they start with a science, which includes physics and society, which is a historical course, and now environmental course, the Blue Planet, and then international relations. And then in the later years, there's a seminar and an internship. Those are the required courses. And the other 12 credit hours are distributed in four categories that are different than Michael's. One is thought, ideology, and ethics, which includes philosophy courses and linguistics and political theory classes. And another one is, as in at Berkeley, methods, methodologies of nonviolence and conflict resolution. That includes mediation and intercultural communication. And then there's an international cluster of courses that gets into disarmament and regional conflicts and regional strategies for alternatives to those conflicts. And then there's a subnational or intergroup, and that includes race and cultural differences, and even family violence would be in there.
What are some of the most critical, significant things that a peace studies program can teach?
It is incredible when students recognize that there's other ways to handle conflict. It's like this huge awakening in their minds. And, you know, the methodology courses and the internship courses, they can see that in action. And most students who haven't sought out alternatives before then are just blown away, and they say it changes their lives, that they now can walk into a conflict and be able to think about how to handle it instead of being sort of trained into dysfunctional ways of handling it.
I can only echo what Christine is saying. One of our students at graduation on Saturday said, well, if you want to sum up peace and conflict studies in one word, it's hope. And look, for example, at what's going on with China. China is now, you know, flexing its muscle, so to speak. And if you read Atlantic, the last edition of that magazine, the only response that people can think of coming up with is, how do we fight them? And that could lead us into a disaster of unparalleled proportions. In fact, it's a disaster already in terms of the alienation. And like they say, if all you've got is a hammer, you treat every problem as though it were a nail. But, you know, another country that's getting up on its feet is not a nail, and it doesn't mean that the only response we can have to it is to smash it. By the time our kids get out of here, they know all of that stuff, and they're going out into a world that doesn't know all of that stuff. And I think when we've reached a critical mass with these brilliant, idealistic young people, we could really put the planet on a safer, better course.
I think what you just said may, in part, answer what I was going to ask next, which is, why should people care that there's a peace studies program in their local university? How is it relevant to them, even though its relevance might not be immediately apparent?
I think its relevance is directly apparent, but it's through people in the community. So when the students go do their internships and they are attracted to human services and they go out and they're actually preferentially hired in those by reputation in those fields because they have some skills and the awareness that there are alternatives is huge. And the impact of it, I'm sure their families are moved. And when they go and work in the world, they carry that. So in some ways, it's that they seed the community with this knowledge that there are other ways.
You know, that's very often what we experience in this whole field is if we do nothing more than provide people with a name for an intuition that they have and an experience that they have that they can now understand and think about systematically and let them take it from there, I think we've done a lot.
One of the things that Peace Studies argues is that you need a unity of means and ends, that there
Absolutely.
Is no such thing as having a peaceful outcome from a violent process, that you must have that integrity of means and ends. And that, I think, makes a huge difference, and it does put you up against people that are arguing, and a whole lot of resources are dedicated to believing or trying to achieve peace through violence. And
right.
it does not work, but that is not visible. We mm. all are deeply invested in hoping that that will work.
I've had such interesting interactions last semester with the military affairs classes. They've invited me in for talks. I've invited them to come in and talk to our classes. And I think that tragic investment in the use of violent means to try to bring about nonviolent or peaceful ends that you were just referring to could very largely be alleviated as soon as people knew that there was an alternative.
I've seen that. I've had ROTC students in my classes, and bless their hearts. I mean, mm-hmm. they come to the class called Peace and Conflict. They sign mm-hmm. up for it. Mm-hmm. And at the end of those classes, that's what they say. I will never again believe
right.
that peace is impossible. I now can see that it is possible through a different mechanism. And that it's a gigantic difference.
Yeah. You know, a friend of mine was in Washington lobbying for the Department of Peace, and she found herself in an elevator with four military people, and they said, well, we're here lobbying for a new weapons system. What are you here for? And so she told them, I'm here lobbying for the Department of Peace. And one of those people had been looking down at the floor without saying anything. And when he heard that, he looked up and he said, please hurry.
This is Peace Talks. I'm Carol Boss, and we're having a conversation today with Michael Nagler, who is founder and former chair of the Peace and Conflict Studies Program at the University of California, Berkeley. He is the author of The Search for a Nonviolent Future, as well as a number of other books. Also with us is Christine Rack, who teaches in the Peace Studies Program at the University of New Mexico. I would think that some would believe that teachers in a Peace Studies curriculum are advocating a political position in that anti-war is considered in the current climate an anti-administration stance. How do you stay neutral in the classroom, or do you?
Well, I present the theory and history and logic of peace, by and large, peace creation, peace development, and in my case especially, nonviolence, and I let people take it from there. Now, obviously, the administration is committed to a different course, so I will often use them, frankly, as examples of the wrong way to go. You know, I'll talk about the Mayaguez episode, for example, where 34 Marines died in an attempt to save 30 merchant Marines who were already being given back by the Cambodians, and I don't make any attempt to conceal my disagreement with the administration, and nor do I think that I would need to or that it would be necessary from the point of view of academic freedom. I would say that I'm in a distinct minority, that even at Berkeley, most professors are much more in line with the administration. And so the students get both sides, and they get to make up their mind, and that's called democracy.
I usually, in fact, I always now say at the beginning of a peace studies class, this is about peace studies, and so there is a values base. There is a, we're going to look at peace, and so we're not going to give equal time to the military perspective. But at the same time, I mean, that in and of itself is pretty radical, because you're suggesting there are other ways than what are currently being done.
Mm-hmm.
We do end up, students say, well, are you, is this anti-U.S.? And, well, it is critical. And so I step very carefully around that, but I don't hide that there, that this course is going to do peace. That's, mm-hmm. That's what we do here.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to ask, how do you teach and develop a culture of peace amidst a culture of violence that's ingrained in us and perpetuated to a large degree by the media?
You know, Carol, in the book of mine that you just mentioned, Search for a Nonviolent Future, I have a list of five things that everybody can do. The first thing that I recommend to people is to break contact with the commercialized mass media. We don't need it for news, and we certainly don't need it for entertainment. And I recommend that people get their news from alternative sources instead, which is very easy to do nowadays. And the second thing that I recommend is that they try to find some kind of spiritual discipline that works for them. And the third thing is that they learn about nonviolence. And then I tell people to act out what they've learned, you know, because the incivility and the very one-on-one local violence is becoming so painful for everybody. And then finally, to get involved in some kind of peace creation activity with the guidelines that I think that you can learn from past history and from certain philosophical models of how nonviolence and social change work.
Do we also need more press, as in publicity, for the success of nonviolent strategies that have actually worked?
Well, that's, I think, what everyone in the field is working on.
Can you give us an example of one, whether it's a classic example, or
mm-hmm.
one perhaps that listeners might not be so familiar
mm-hmm.
with?
The one that we feel is probably the most important in terms of its overall significance is called the Rosenstrasse prison demonstration. And that was in 1943 in Berlin. The Gestapo arrested Jewish men who had not been arrested up till that point because they were married to non-Jewish wives. And against all expectations, these wives started collecting at the detention center and demanding their men back. And the Gestapo, frankly, was flummoxed. They didn't know what to do. You know, got 6,000, 7,000 women in the street. They stayed there all weekend. The end result, to make a long story short, was that all those men were released. And we found out only recently, because nobody does research on this stuff, but we found out recently that these men were saved. They were not rearrested. And so here's, you know, a bunch of women who knew nothing about nonviolence, I think we can assume, and had no plan, and no follow-up. It was, in other words, it was nonviolence about as weak as it could be, and yet it overcame the power of Nazism, of the Gestapo. And when you really start unpacking that story, you realize that, you know, if we had started soon enough, we would not have had to have had World War II. We could have stopped Hitler through nonviolent resistance.
If we had started early enough.
If we started early enough and knew what we were doing. And mm-hmm. sure enough, if you look at the recent history, there's this wave mm-hmm. of insurrectionary movements that have deposed tyrants, in Georgia, in, of course, starting the Otpor resistance in Belgrade, and then Georgia and the Ukraine, and heading on now to
Ecuador.
Right, and Uzbekistan. And so, as Christine was saying before, it's just an incredible power of an alternative. And if you see it at work and know how to explain how it works, it has a positive revolutionary potential.
So thank you so much, Michael Nagler, Professor Emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, and Christine Rack from the University of New Mexico's Peace Studies Program.
Thanks for having me.
Very glad to be here.
We now want to turn to our next guest. Graham Bass will be entering his senior year at Earlham College in their Peace and Global Studies department. He has just returned from Northern Ireland, where he spent a semester studying and working. So, Graham, why don't you tell us about your decision to attend college at Earlham, which is a Quaker college?
To begin with, Earlham was the only college, one of the only colleges that I found that had a peace studies program. It's not an easy major to find, and Earlham, aside from having excellent credentials otherwise, was one of the few colleges that I found that did have this program.
Well, what interests you in finding a peace studies program?
Well, wanting to do something. Money really wasn't something that I was concerned about earning a lot of. So I wasn't trying to find a particularly lucrative profession, more one that was personally satisfying and that I could go to sleep at night and feel at least halfway decent about myself and kind of satisfied the unwritten checklist in the back of my conscience and my heart as to what I wanted to do.
Now that you've been in the program for 3 years, what do you consider to be some of the most important things that you've learned thus far?
I think, and especially having just returned to Northern Ireland, that was probably the most educational experience I've had within the program. The thing that opened up to me was I had just finished spending a semester studying conflict resolution, which is, of course, a foundation of peace studies. And going to Northern Ireland kind of blew that out of the water for me. I thought that conflict resolution was something that, you know, I could use to change the world, help people everywhere, you know, kind of your bombastic, enthusiastic sounding title of all the great things you can do with it. And no, not at all. It completely restructured the way I look at it, and I no longer view it as some sort of world-changing thing, but more of a, this is how you solve a conflict when two people are about to yell at each other and possibly throw punches. And that's a much different scale of what you view a conflict as Protestant and Catholics having a conflict in a country over who's got the right to live where or who has the right to look at a specific version of an image of a deity. You know, it's a very different set of qualifications as to what you're trying to resolve. And I think that was the biggest epiphany for me in terms of my formal education was just seeing that the scope of difference between what one person considers a conflict and the other person, any person considers a conflict, can be enormous, and that the tactics for dealing with those are vastly, vastly different. We took a second conflict resolution class in Northern Ireland, which was international conflict resolution, although this is really an intranational conflict. But that aside, it has very different methods that one would choose to use in addressing a conflict, even from the very formative stages to outright violence, that one of the things that was that Christine mentioned was active listening. And active listening, I think, is possibly one of the few techniques that can be easily transferred between simple conflict resolution and what a prominent theorist named Johann Galtung would term conflict transformation. And I think that was the largest point of the epiphany, was the difference between what conflict resolution can do and especially what you're saying when you say conflict resolution, because that implies that you can resolve a conflict. And I think that it's simply impossible to, as we use the word resolve, to resolve some conflicts. In light of further reading and education, I would now say that they need to be transformed.
Let me ask you what you think about the importance of peace studies programs and the inspiration it's provided you.
I think the importance is, to echo the sentiments of your two earlier guests, that there is an alternative, and that that alternative works. Now, it's that it's hard to make arguments for peace studies, and I think this is one of its limitations, is that it does have to be largely spiritually based. Unlike war, which is very easily mentally or biologically triggered through training or through hormones, its importance is offering an alternative method as well as an alternative spirituality for conflict transformation, I would say.
And in terms of the inspiration it's provided you, do you have ideas for your future, what you would like to do?
Oh, the loaded question of all loaded questions. I'm very interested in the Peace Corps, in human rights work, possibly with a law degree, in community organization and community development, which was one of the very important lessons that I learned in Northern Ireland. I've never seen so much community organization and community development as I have in Northern Ireland. It absolutely is astounding. And the things that they've done to improve their communities are phenomenal. So I think that that has been a very strong influence on me.
Thank you so much, Graham.
Thank you for having me on your show.
I've been talking with Graham Bass, who will be entering his senior year at Earlham College.
There's more about Peace Studies programs, as well as audio of this show and extended interviews with each of our guests on the website peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can also hear all the other programs in our series, learn about upcoming shows, and send us your comments. Support for this program comes from the McCune Charitable Foundation of New Mexico, making grants to enrich the cultural life, health, education, environment, and spiritual life of the citizens of New Mexico. Also, support from the Peace Tales CD Project, creator of the Peace Tales for Kids CD, online at peacetales.org. Additional support from KUNM at the University of New Mexico, and from listeners like you. You can learn how to support this program online at peacetalksradio.com. The show was hosted by Carol Boss, engineered and edited by Paul Ingalls, with assistance from Neil Yamagata in Berkeley. Music by Ali Adelman. Peace Talks is a production of Good Radio Shows Incorporated, a nonprofit media organization creating radio programs and online content meant to inform, inspire, and improve the human condition. On the web at goodradioshows.org. Thanks for listening.